So we are in the molecular and cell biology department at UC Berkeley with Yang Dan, who's a professor here, a neurobiologist, neuroscientist, a Howard Hughes investigator as of 2008.
Yes.
Congratulations on that. So let's just start with that. Funding of science is a huge issue, very much. I've talked to younger scientists recently at a couple of meetings where they actually said they feared they were going to be the lost generation, that the science, that the funding was being cut back so radically. Some major institutions, like the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, are there and fund investigators. They fund people. They fund individuals with their labs. The Wellcome Institute has now decided that it will fund individuals as
right.
well.
Right.
So this is a safety net for people. I mean, right. you must feel huge relief at this point. With
absolutely, yeah, huge relief.
So you get to actually go on with the science.
Yes.
The trouble is that the question that then comes up is what if you're not one of these select few?
Lucky
what
people,
happens
right?
to yeah the lucky people? What happens to the young scientists who are out there wondering what to do next? How do they get grants and so on? So, you know, you wonder a little bit. Do you think about this?
I think about it all the time. Actually, before I got the Howard Hughes, there were about 2 years period. I was so frustrated. I spent the majority of my time writing grants and just getting turned down for good reasons, bad reasons, but you know, in the end, I lost faith in the system. Mm-hmm. I seriously thought about going back to China because the funding was improving there. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, you know, just spending all the time writing grants and not being able to think about my science was just not worth it.
Yeah. So how do you sense the climate in China at the moment? We've obviously just spoken to Mu Ming, so have a sense of what he's been doing with the Chinese Academy.
I think in many ways it's the temporal derivative of the funding that matters, right? It's not the absolute amount of money. In China, clearly the amount of funding doesn't compare to the US, not even close. Mm. But the trajectory is going up. And so I think that that's a very, you know, this is a very good time. And in fact, you know, in recent years, we see a lot more young people going back to China. They make the decision to go back much more easily in the last few years than before. And funding is a big reason. And I think the Chinese funding system is not perfect. It has advantages and disadvantages. The disadvantage is that there's not a critical mass of good reviewers who can really evaluate the science, right? You propose a project and there are just not enough experts to understand it enough to make a real evaluation. Mm-hmm. That's probably a bad thing. So sometimes they waste money on the projects that are not so good. But the advantage is that they emphasize the productivity much more than what you propose. Mm-hmm. And actually, personally, I think that's a better system because you reward people who have been productive in the last few years. Mm-hmm. And if you stop being productive, you just have to get less resources.
So let's talk about specifically what area of research interests you particularly at the moment. I mean, there's a backlog of things on visual illusions and very interesting work which I recommend that people read. But the new work, I suppose, deriving to some extent from a paper that we talked about that was in Science in May 2009 about burst spiking of a single cortical neuron modifying global brain states, so which was a remarkable result. It was like flipping a switch and shifting from one brain state to another. So brain states is the kind of thing that interests you at the moment, and I'd be interested to hear you talk about that and how that connects with the Temporal Dynamics of Learning Centers agenda, since you're one of the PIs on the one of the members of one of the networks on the TDLC.
Yeah, so first, in general, brain states, I think it's an incredibly interesting problem. We all have different brain states. You know, we sleep, we are awake, and there are different types of sleep, REM sleep, during which we dream, or slow wave sleep, where we're just in a deep slumber. And in the awake states, we have attentive, aroused state, or we are kind of drowsy, or we're relaxed. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you know, there's a lot of earlier data indicating that these different brain states are associated with very distinct patterns of global activity patterns, like you can measure in EEG, right? So there are certainly people who are interested in what regulates sleep, because there are a lot of insomnia people who are bothered by sleep disorders. But I think the problem of brain state is broader than just sleep-wake. Personally, I'm more interested in, you know, what regulates arousal, attention versus relaxed, sort of introspective. Sometimes you are very attentive to the sensory stimuli, like when I'm talking to you, right? I really want to hear every word that you say, and suppress a lot of my internal thoughts. But sometimes I like to just think about things, and I want to shut out the sensory input. And so the general guess is that the different brain states are good for different things. So we're interested in two questions. One is, what mechanisms control the brain states? What control the switching between different states? And our guess is that the neuromodulatory circuits, like acetylcholine, dopamine, norepinephrine, serotonin, and et cetera, they'll probably all play important roles. But how these circuits interact, something that we don't know a whole lot about. So that's one question, what controls the brain states?
Right.
The other question is, what are the functions served by the different brain states? So that's probably a bigger question. But I think it's very important, because sometimes some states we know are good for sensory processing, but why do we need these other states? Are they good for thinking, right? Which is the ultimate form of high-level brain function.
You mean, so what's happening when you're introspecting or reflecting?
Yeah,
So two things spring to mind. One, first of all, obviously, is that translates, you'd think that that would translate into a whole science of educating, a science of learning, because if you can facilitate, train, or whatever you want to, any of these learning states, then that should be productive.
Right.
Well, let's deal with that one first. I mean, so how do you go about the business of trying to figure that out? What's the protocol?
So we're pretty new in this area, so we're just sort of starting to put our thoughts together, how to look at the problem. And you know, the literature, there's a lot of them, but pretty confusing right now. So I have to say that what we're thinking about is pretty preliminary now.
Right.
But one of the things that we're thinking about is probably the neuromodulatory circuits that are involved in controlling brain states are themselves plastic. So one idea to pursue, which is something we're actively discussing with a TDLC like Paula Talal and Terry Snowski and others, Andrea Chiba, is this idea of learning how to learn, right? So when you learn things, you store new information in your brain, and a lot of people study that, right? Synaptic plasticity, and you know, in the cortex, hippocampus, and so forth. And we've been studying that area a lot. But, you know, since I teach undergraduate students regularly, I sort of noticed that some people are just better learners than others, right? It's not like they start at the same level. They didn't know the information. But some people are able to absorb the information, understand them, synthesize them much more quickly than others, right? So there's this idea of learning how to learn. It's a form of, I guess you could say, metaplasticity, right? It's not the plasticity itself. It's like you learn how to use your plasticity better, something along that line. Right? This is a big area, and we're not exactly sure what circuits are involved. But one idea is that maybe the neuromodulatory circuits are involved. So for example, we know that the acetylcholine, the cholinergic system in the basal forebrain is one of the circuits involved in controlling attention. And in fact, we published some studies recently along that line. So the question is, first of all, there's a question of why aren't we evolved to have our cholinergic system active all the time, right? So it's active sometimes, and that's presumably the time that you're paying attention, but it's not active all the time. So if you learn to control your system better, so you know to pay attention at the right time to the right subject, maybe that's one reason why some people are better learners than others.
Right. So this is a comment I've made before to people, and made it at this meeting that we had recently about discussion about the XPRIZE and Education XPRIZE, is that a lot of the recent media has been decrying the capacities of teachers, and has been talking about firing bad teachers, and there have been a lot of stories about building a better teacher. And I think we talked at this meeting about, well, perhaps we should be talking about building a better learner. So this fits in very well with what you're talking about. How do you define what the contours of the learning experience are, and how do you come up with some metrics to sort of figure out how to improve that? Where does the timing part come into that? Is this in terms of, well,
where the timing?
It's about time, right?
Yeah. So now we do have a specific project with TDLC looking at timing, relating both timing and brain state. But what I just said is probably much broader than that, and I'm sure there are many angles that, you know, that broad umbrella can be related to timing. But maybe I can tell you first about the project that we have with TDLC.
Sure.
So the idea is the following. We have some preliminary data. This is done in the rat visual cortex, but probably doesn't matter. Any part of the cortex will probably find the same thing. So the finding is the following. Now, we've been studying spike timing dependent plasticity, which is a very prominent form of synaptic plasticity, and you know, there's a lot of theoretical studies suggesting, you know, it can the synaptic learning rule allows neural circuits to learn smart things, and we as experimentalists have demonstrated this form of plasticity in many synapses.
So we're talking about strengthening connections.
Exactly. Yeah. So in this particular learning rule, timing is critical, because if the presynaptic cell fires before the postsynaptic cell by 10 milliseconds, you get long-term potentiation. But if you flip the timing just by 10 milliseconds, then you get long-term depression. So here, timing is critical on the order of milliseconds or tens of milliseconds. Mm-hmm. So the study that we did is, we were led to that direction by our preliminary finding.
Could I just interject one
sure,
thing
yeah.
there? When you're talking about timing being off there, how does that happen?
That's a big question, right? So, in general, each neuron receives thousands of inputs in the cortex, right? And so it's driven not just by the presynaptic neuron you happen to be studying, right? So if it's driven by other presynaptic cells so that they fire at the right timing or the wrong timing, then that would directly influence the change of the synapse that you're studying.
Yeah, I guess what I'm getting at is for people at home, for example.
Okay.
You can understand what looking at a slice and very carefully monitoring timing and the progression of events.
Right.
But as you know from your May paper, when you just flip one switch, the entire global brain state changes.
Right. Right.
You in a real brain, you can't do just one thing.
Right, right.
It just, there's a massive cascades of things.
Right,
happen.
Exactly.
So how do you explain to somebody, if you had to explain to somebody at home, or for example, what the intricacies are of finding how to improve or the timing proceedings in an active, live, working brain sitting here, you know.
Maybe I can give you an example that has some, you know, intuitive relationship with real life, right? So, for example, you can actually use sensory patterns of sensory stimuli to determine the timing of neural spiking, right? So, for example, in the visual cortex, we have neurons looking at different parts of the visual field, right? They're called the receptive fields, right? So if you have a moving pattern, right, some moving object, which is very common in the environment. If you have a moving object going across the visual field, now you might hit the receptive field of one neuron before the other, right? Mm-hmm. So that presumably is going to cause a sequence of spiking between mm-hmm. these neurons. And so for neurons looking at here, a neuron looking at here, and if this object moves this way, this neuron will fire before this neuron. And so if they have connections with each other, right, you would predict, according to spike timing dependent plasticity, that the synapse from this one to that one will be strengthened, mm-hmm. but the reciprocal will be depressed, mm-hmm. right? So this is just one example in the visual system, but you can talk about, you know, local motion of the animal, they move across the environment in a sequence, right? That can activate different hippocampal neurons in a certain sequence, right? So basically, the real life experience translates to the timing of neuron of neuronal firing in a pretty direct manner.
So what would be an example of a dysfunctional system? Is dyslexia something like that, for example?
I think dyslexia would be very relevant. Now, the auditory system, I'm not an expert in that area, but I think part of the problem with dyslexia, I think from Mike Wernick's work and Paolo Talau's work, is that they have problem with timing. So they can't perceive auditory stimuli that are different at very fast time scales. That's my understanding of one symptom of, not symptom, but maybe one cause for dyslexia, right? And so if they have, their neurons can't represent timing of the sensory stimuli at that time scale, it's very easy to imagine that their synaptic plasticity can also be messed up.
Yeah, but huge effects in practical existence.
Exactly, so, exactly.
Anyway, I just wanted to sort of give people a context for the kind of work you're talking about. So, so on with your brain states.
So. Yeah. So basically, what we found is, you know, spike timing dependent plasticity, which I described before, has been found in many circuits, mostly in vitro in slices, right? And there are some studies in vivo, but people haven't looked at the dependence of that on brain state very closely. And what we found is that this synaptic learning rule, which is a very microscopic phenomenon, actually depends on the global brain state. So in a brain state that's sort of analogous to REM sleep and also somewhat similar to the awake states, at least measured from EEG pattern, we found that the learning rule is consistent with what people found in slices. But in the other state, which is more similar to slow wave sleep, deep sleep, the learning rule is actually reversed. So now the presynaptic neuron, if it fires before the postsynaptic neuron, you actually get long-term depression. Whereas if you have pre-after post, you get LTP. So this is the
long-term
opposite.
Exactly.
So this is the opposite from what people found in slices and also in this REM sleep kind of state.
So where do you think this might lead? What's your hypothesis about this?
The hypothesis? So right now we're just doing experiments just to confirm this initial finding, and also we wanted to look at some cellular mechanisms. But at the functional level, obviously we would like to do more experiments to, you know, under the more natural situations. Right now we're doing the experiments in anesthetized animals, but soon we want to, you know, do it in animals going through natural sleep just to see if this effect could be dependent on anesthesia, which we hope it doesn't, right? But the functional relevance, at the moment, I can only speculate. So there's actually a theoretical study from Jeff Hinton's group, I believe. They have this model of neural network, and they train the network to learn very smart things, like, you know, recognizing handwritten characters or letters or something, right? And part of the learning rule they found is that if there's a so-called sleep state, when the network is not receiving the sensory input, right? So part of the network, part of the time the network is getting sensory input, right? They're seeing the letters and the characters, and they're modifying their connections in the network. so that the network can do a better job recognizing. But if they add another phase to the network, in which they don't provide the sensory input, so they call this the sleep-like state, right? If they flip the rule, right? So sorry, I forgot to say that during the sensory period, the network learning rule is very similar to spike timing dependent plasticity.
Okay.
But in this so-called sleep state, if they reverse the rule, just like what we found, then the network does even better than if they didn't have the sleep state.
Isn't that counterintuitive?
It's kind of counterintuitive, and I can't pretend that I understand everything about their model, but that seems to be one prediction of their modeling work.
Yeah. Well, we shall, as you know, this is a beginning of a large collection of conversations with people. At some point, I missed Jeff when he was in town recently, but we'll have to have a conversation with Jeff and see
with
what
him,
he's talking
yeah.
about as well.
Right,
and
right.
we'll piece all these things together like a large jigsaw puzzle, I hope. You were born in China?
Yes.
So how did you finally go into science? I mean, there's partly a story here in the what the Howard Hughes Medical Institute says about you. It says that you had a should I read this? It says you had a head start in math. In your hometown of Beijing, her father, a nuclear physicist, taught her elementary math. So that's a pretty good start.
Yeah, it's a very good start. Yeah.
So maths was a really driving force for you. Or were you driven into it?
No, I always really enjoyed it. I think that my dad had this way of.
He's a good teacher?
He's a fantastic teacher. Yeah, he made me feel that I wanted to do it myself rather than he was making me doing it.
Yeah.
But by the time I went to school, I was way ahead of other kids. And so, you know, I would always win these sort of math competitions or something. So that became part of life.
Yeah.
Yeah, at that point, I didn't need him to push me anything. I just had to do it myself.
And neuroscience depends upon math, knowing some math and so on, but you went through physics to get to neuroscience?
Yeah.
Why did you decide to go to neuroscience instead of staying in physics?
I actually always wanted to study biology. I didn't know so much about neuroscience at the time. But even after high school, I wanted to study biology for a vague notion that I wanted to understand the mystery of life, right? I didn't really know much about what biology is all about, but I figured it's somewhat related to that fundamental mystery. But my dad, again, gave me the advice that he said that at the time in China, the college education in biology is very memory driven, not very concept driven.
You mean rote? Kind of.
Exactly, yeah. So they make you memorize a lot of things. And so he thought it's probably a waste of time to do it that early in life. And he thought that studying physics is a good general training for your logical thinking and for a way of looking at things.
I was doing we were at a meeting recently. It was a Keystone Symposium meeting on aging, and I talked with a researcher there who's, I think, in Berkeley, Danica Chen, who had also grown up in China. And I was asking her if there was any, if she found any distinction between the way in which young women and young men were treated, girls in schools and so on. She actually said she didn't think there was much of a difference. She didn't feel that she was discriminated against as a girl, wanting to be an academic and so on. What was your experience?
I completely agree with her.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think in China, on the one hand, you know, at least the time that we were growing up, it's pretty backwards economically and in many aspects. But socially, there wasn't a lot of discrimination. I never felt, nobody ever told me that I should think of myself any less than a boy.
Yeah. So, how did you end up being here?
Being in the US?
First in the States, and then, yeah.
Right. So when I was in college, there wasn't much research in China. Obviously, in the last 10, 15 years, things have changed dramatically. But at the time, there wasn't a lot of research. So for people who want to have a career in research, most of us came to the US. That was our only way to ever have the opportunity for research career.
Mm-hmm.
So just like all the other students, I applied to graduate school at the end of my undergraduate period.
And came to?
I went to Columbia University in New York.
Right. What led you into this particular area of science then?
So let's see. When I was applying for graduate school, I applied to a bunch of physics departments because I was a physics major. And the way I was educated in China, I only studied physics, nothing else. So I didn't know anything about biology, even though I was determined to switch to biology.
Ah.
So I applied to some physics departments, I got in, but I also got into Columbia biology. That to me was a happy accident. I was just gonna try it without much hope, but I got in. And so when I went in there, I was starting to learn biology from scratch, basically. And so I realized in my first year that I wanted to study neuroscience. I didn't even know it as a discipline before that. So I discovered that and I liked it. But the labs that were in the department, they were mostly at the cellular level.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ended in lab, I learned a great deal about how to do research and so forth. But in my fourth year in graduate school, when I started thinking about the future, I also realized that my true interest is at the systems level. I like to know how circuits work and how, you know, circuits mediate high-level function rather than
right.
just how a single neuron works as a cell. And so I switched as a postdoc to the systems levels. And I guess that's the start.
But you concentrated on vision to begin with, right? Visual system.
Right.
And tell me about the work on visual illusions. How did you get into that?
Visual illusions. It wasn't a plan. Ahead. You know, I got into vision again later than many of my peers because they started doing it in graduate school, but I got into it as a postdoc. And so again, I had a very sort of outsider's mentality. I didn't know what it was all about. And so I started reading papers, and again, not necessarily the conventional set of papers. I just read somewhat randomly. And the illusion seemed fascinating because it seems like people are using it as a tool to push your visual system to fail and use the failures to figure out how your system is wired up. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's sort of the main motivation for looking at the neural mechanism of illusion.
So which kind of papers were you reading at that point? Who do you remember any particular major stimulus, impetus coming from anywhere?
I can't think of anything in particular. You know, I actually had a book about visual illusions, and I also can't remember the author of the book. Sorry.
Yeah. Anyway, this sounds like a much grander vision that you're working on now. If you're talking about those kind of neuromodulatory systems, or if you're talking about dopaminergic systems, acetylcholinergic systems, as Mu Ming was saying, you'll begin to start thinking about things like being addicted to learning.
Yes.
And that's a very interesting concept.
Exactly. Yeah, that's actually a very central concept that we're talking about at TDLC, you know, when we're planning for the renewal of the next cycle of the grant.
Yeah, so how do you see that going?
Are you asking what we plan to do along that line? Or
in terms of the impact, I think the large impact that something that kind of a strategy could have, that kind of trajectory.
Yeah, I think that if
especially
we can
if you're
really
talking about science of learning centers.
Yeah, exactly. I think if we can figure out, you know, first of all, the neural mechanisms of the reward for learning, right? And then, in particular, if we can figure out how to, you know, add behavioral paradigms to boost that effect, then I think the impact will be tremendous. I mean, again, come back to my own example. I think the reason why, as a kid, I really liked math, right, which sounds kind of unusual because math is considered dry and all that. And I think that my dad has this magic way of somehow activating my reward circuit. I'm pretty sure that's what happened, right? So you know, doing math becomes like game, becomes fun, and becomes addictive.
What did your mother do, by the way? Was she an educator or anything like that?
My mother is a scholar of Chinese ancient language, so yes. she I guess you could consider her career in social science, but not natural science.
Okay. Is there anything that you ever considered doing if you hadn't been a scientist?
Not anything serious that I can remember. You know, when I was 5 years old, I was thinking about being a ballet dancer, but I'm sure every girl had that thought, but quickly realized it's not for everybody.
Yeah. One of the questions that I've asked a lot of people, and again, it's very relevant because you're coming from a different background, from being born in China, is that the place of science in a society and the way in which it is viewed, the esteem in which it is held, and so on. And in his inaugural address, President Obama said that his administration, one of their plans was to restore science to its rightful place. Didn't say what that was, but I've been asking people, what do you think is the rightful place of science?
That's a big question, but I think, you know, from his point of view, I'm sure one thing that's urgent is that they need to listen to scientists more seriously than just simply ignore scientists. I'm sure, you know, everybody knows that during the Bush years, this whole thing about climate change were just, you know, ignored, right? And so no policies were made according to what scientists were saying seriously. I think that that's an obvious thing to do. And I think that personally, I certainly hope that he would put funding for science at a higher priority, like we were just talking about before. I think that right now the funding situation is really dismal and young people are scared away. I've had postdocs in my lab who saw how I was struggling for funding before I got HHMI. And you know, I had one fantastic postdoc. She just said, you know, I don't want to do this. I don't think I can do this. So she moved and did something else. Mm. And so I think that there is a real danger of losing a whole generation of young scientists.
Is there much more funding going into basic? One of the things I think I remember reading, even Mu Ming saying this, was that even as the funding increases in China, it's still being applied more to development rather than basic research. And that one of the things he was very concerned about doing, I don't know if you agree with this, is getting more basic research done. Things that don't have an immediate obvious reward.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, you know, it almost becomes a cliche to say, you know, Maxwell equations, when he was studying it, he wasn't thinking about electricity and all of the technology that we're using, but look where we are today, right? Yeah. Without that, it's impossible, right? So I think the problem is that for lay people, it's hard to appreciate the fact that basic research in the long run is really going to benefit humanity. But you just have to look beyond the immediate future and look in the long run.
No, it's just difficult if you've got people complaining about how much money is
exactly
being spent and so on and so forth. Have you, who would you list, and you can time travel on this one if you want to, great sources of inspiration for you, people that you might, you mentioned Maxwell, for example, people you would love to have sat down possibly and had dinner with, if you could have invited them over to dinner, who would you have liked to have met or talked to?
Einstein, Richard Feynman. even Francis Crick. I sat down with him at the lunch, but very briefly. When I was interviewing for a job at Salk.
Mm.
I wish I had more time to talk to him.
Yeah. But there's somebody who was originally physicist, became a neuroscientist, looking at consciousness and so on, so, and brain states.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Feynman, because?
I read many different versions of biography or sort of stories about him, and he just seems to be a remarkably original kind of person. I admired him ever since I was in high school.
Yeah.
Actually, I really thought I got admitted to Caltech Physics Graduate School, and the reason why I didn't go was he actually died then. And I said, okay, that's the final push. I'm not going there. There's no reason to.
Oh, heavens. So the reason you're a neuroscientist is that Dick Feynman died.
Yeah.
that's very interesting. And you're right. He was. There was a book about him called No Ordinary Genius, and I think that's probably true. So one other thing that I tend to ask people is, what are you optimistic about at this point?
Optimistic about? I think I'm optimistic that in my lifetime we can make tremendous progress in understanding how the brain works. That's the most, I can be optimistic about a lot of things, but this is the thing I care about the most.
Okay, so do you think that you'll be doing that here, or do you see a time when you'll be going back to China?
One thing I know about myself is that I can't make long-term predictions. I change my mind every few years. Right now, I think the next 5 years, I'm probably here, but beyond that, I don't know.
Yeah. So you also go back and with Muming and for the this building up. He seems extremely excited about this building up of the Institute for Neurosciences and so on. Do you're involved in this as well?
Not involved in the same way as he does. He's really trying to run the institute and build up the institute. I go there for personal reasons. I just want to spend more time with him. If I don't go, I almost never see him. but there I have some, I work with his students. He has a lab there, I don't. But I work with some of his students whose interests are in systems neuroscience. So I go there just to do science. I'm not involved in the administrative activities in the institute.
I talk to lots of couples about being, you know, in science and so on, about how easy it is to make it work and so on. And it's most of them say it's pretty tough. I mean, how do you?
I disagree. I think it works very well.
So how do you make it work?
How do I make it work? I don't know. It just worked out really well for us. I think one thing is that we really understand each other. Especially, I'm more junior than Muming is. And so in the years before I got tenure, I was constantly stressed out. My lab wasn't really running very smoothly, and, you know, funding and all of that. And I think he really understand. And if he didn't understand why I was in bad mood all the time, it would be a big problem for us, I think.
Oh, so he was sort of been there, done that, and was able to sort of give you counsel and support. And
yeah, exactly.
Understanding and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so I'm looking forward to hearing how the brain states works develops, and we'll pick that up in the next conversation.
All right. Great.
Good to talk to you.
Right. Good to talk to you.
Thanks.